Yeah, so review class this week. I hope you have questions, or I hope as we go through an informal review, questions will come up. And so we can address them as they do arrive in your mind, as you capture the questions in your mind. And the online people, as the questions come up, please jot them down so that you don't lose them again. Okay, just try and get this. So the quote that we'll start with just before, and as we set our motivation, you know, the Vajra vehicle, the lightning vehicle, the tantric vehicle, if we do enter this vehicle, then enlightenment in one short lifetime of a being of the degenerate age, from the first initial practice of Tantra until the attainment of Buddhahood. So this is really extraordinary. Remember how on the Mahayana Sutra path, it's three countless great eons it takes to become a Buddha. Or if you played the rebirth game here, you know, and throwing a one is the best and a six is down, you go to the lower realms. In the rebirth game, if you throw a one 11 times in a row, you get to enlightenment. Without any doubt. So, you know, they've worked the odds out. So it doesn't mean that we can't help people along the way on those three countless great eons. In fact, they're probably three countless joyous eons, or a lot of it is joyous. And Venerable Gyatso did say in Bendigo that we're right at the end of our three countless great eons, where we are now. We're completing them. We're not at the beginning of them, we're completing them, and we've met the tantric path. But what's amazing about this is that it's from when you first come across Tantra. So even if you're middle-aged and you come across Buddhism and then come across Tantra, which is what happened to my mother, then you can make really good strides forward, and in fact can become enlightened in one lifetime. If not in retreat in that lifetime, then certainly at your death time. And if you don't become enlightened at death time, then certainly you can make it to the pure land and continue there, and then come back to a perfect human rebirth. The tantric vehicle really is the lightning vehicle, and because it's fast and furious, then we need to make sure that that we do it well, we do it properly, we don't cut any corners, that we stay safe from the claws of samsara. So let's just take a moment to adjust our motivation for tonight's class. First, adjusting your posture. So first adjusting body and then adjusting the mind. So for the posture, the really simple two-part posture is to straighten your spine and then relax your body. So this is a way of positioning our body so that it's perfectly middle way. A bit of energy and effort into keeping the spine straight, and how our spine then supports the rest of our body, that we can then relax our neck and shoulders, arms, legs, because we're supported by our spine. Feel how your seat supports you, how you're grounded. Bring your focus just to the gentle rolling rhythm of the breath. And in doing so, let go of the busyness of the day. And becoming present in the room, present to your own awareness. We find ourselves in a perfect human rebirth in the most fortunate of circumstances. Not necessarily fortunate for a career or for taking an enormous holidays, but fortunate for becoming enlightened. For that, we have everything at our fingertips. We have all the leisure and opportunity that we need to attain the highest possible goal. So feeling how incredibly fortunate or lucky we are, and then recognizing that the rest of the sentient beings are crying out for help. They have no freedom, completely dominated by their sufferings and their disturbing emotions. And we are the ones who can do something. In just a few short years, and then in particular, setting our motivation tonight that just like the Buddha said, don't take what I say just because I say so. Take what I say and test it against your own experience and ask questions and analyze. So for our review class, setting our motivation to take the Buddha's teachings to heart and that attitude of insatiable curiosity, the courage to question, to develop our wisdom and develop our wisdom grounded in a good heart. The work for oneself, developing authentic renunciation and abhorrence towards samsara, both not just the lows but the highs. And the work for others, recognizing that others are just like us with hopes and fears, just like us wanting happiness and no problems. And because we're here, we can actually help them. So thinking of all others from that deep recognition of how all others are just like us, regardless of the kind of appearance that they have at the moment. So with this kind of attitude, I'll just read the Bodhisattva Bodhicitta prayer. With the wish to free all beings, I shall always go for refuge to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until I reach full enlightenment. Inspired by wisdom and compassion, today in the Buddha's presence, I generate the mind of full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain and dispel the miseries of the world. So then a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. And we can kind of go through our review class. So what we've covered, I've just got the kind of the little list here, and I've got a few couple of slides about each one. So we looked at the unique characteristics of Tantra, the six names of Tantra, and what makes Tantra so special. How the foundation is the three principal aspects of the path, which we have learned about in previous Discovering Buddhism units. The three gates to enter Tantra, which is a way of figuring out for ourselves, am I ready? Am I ready for this path? How to tell if we're ready? Certainly not by using our kind of just worldly concerns, but looking at what's the process that we have to go through. And within that, the responsibilities of the student, and then how to recognize a qualified teacher. And going in that order, first looking at our own stuff, and then looking for the qualified teacher, and making a lot more than just a decision made on charisma or just kind of going with the flow, but having a real analysis, both of oneself and of the teacher. The four classes of Tantra. The four Buddha bodies. And the substantial causes for the body and mind of a Buddha for enlightened, for full enlightenment. We then had a look, kind of more deep dive into the path of action tantra with the Nyungne example, and then the path of high soga tantra. And the importance of visualization, pujas and retreat. So that was also one of my most fun classes, but I can gather it was one of Ben and Maureen's most fun classes. We're bringing in the whole Western kind of neuroscience aspect of things, the how the two streams come together so nicely. And then the key to success, guru devotion. Without guru devotion, realizations are not possible. So we have actually covered a huge amount of stuff in a very short amount of time. So if your head feels full, no wonder. So I thought just slowly we'd go through a few of those things. Let's see, take this over here now. So the six names of Tantra and my acronym, Secret Mr. Vajra and his method canon. So does anyone remember what those six names were? I'll give you a hint. The first one's right there. Secret. And mantra.
Resultant.
And all the methods and the canon of the
Vijadharas,
wisdom holders. Vajradharas, close. Vijadharas. So, why does it need to be secret? That's right. We do it internally. We're not kind of just being show-offs about it. Yeah. Mantra. Does anyone remember?
Mind protection.
That's it. Mind protection. Protecting the mind from?
Ordinary.
Yes. Ordinary appearances. The tyranny of ordinary appearances. And that's probably the most important thing about the tantric path. Resultant, that fake it till you make it, taking the future result into the present. Vajra, do you remember?
Adamantine,
meaning?
Diamond.
Yeah, so indestructible. And what's indestructible?
The emptiness of the mind.
Yes. The emptiness, the purity of the mind, the continuity of the mind, in fact. So it's not that we turn into something else. There is this continuity there, that fundamental purity. Then all the various methods, skillful means. Using everything on the path. And the canon of the Vijadharas. Yes, common and uncommon attainments. So this is all the help from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and in particular the practices to extend our life, to avert obstacles so that we can actually complete the path. So was there any issues, questions, doubts about this one, about the way of describing what's unique about Tantra? And of course, the Mahayana Tantra is not separate from Mahayana Sutra. It builds on it. And so even with our various tantric sadhanas, Chenrezig Sadhana or Tara Sadhana, it might have a few refuge prayers in the middle, in the beginning, and then the sadhana, and then a few dedications at the end. It's not that we only need to do those few prayers. It's taken that we are so familiar with them that we just need a little reminder. But actually we can do a whole lot more refuge and bodhicitta and everything at the beginning and all the way through. Okay, so then the qualities of the student. So the three faults to abandon just generally, and I put these in and I've left them in because I think it's worth being reminded again and again to avoid those three faults, the upside down vessel of just being closed-minded, arrogant, asleep, or tired even, you know, when you're just overwhelmed by life and nothing else is going in. So it's, there's a whole range of things for the upside down vessel, but the most dangerous one is just this, what might be termed as like intellectual arrogance, where we just think we know. And so then we have no chance of learning anything else. The dirty vessel, bringing our own baggage with us, we don't even know we have, except what happens is that our experience of the path becomes yucky. And this happens a lot to people where might start procrastinating about Dharma practice or start getting an aversion to coming to pujas. And it's not because there's anything wrong with the Dharma, but we've contaminated it in some way and we've spoilt it for ourselves. So what I found with this is to actually give yourself a break and not berate yourself and make it worse, but actually encourage yourself and say, ah, if I'm experiencing obstacles, like internal obstacles to this, I'm missing a piece of the puzzle. So which piece of the puzzle am I missing? And on Monday night with Geshe Zopa's teaching, so when he was talking about how to develop equanimity, the first thing was from a mind of openness and relaxation. So I never actually heard it spelt out like that, but it's that important. And because we don't naturally do that, then we're just bringing our dirty coffee cup to everything. So finding the joy or cleaning the dirty coffee cup isn't about berating yourself, feeling guilty, fighting against it, anything like that. It's finding the bit about the Dharma that you love and doing that and reconnecting that way. And the cracked vessel in one ear, out the other. And that kind of comes from just not studying enough. So enjoy your study, savor the journey, instead of kind of being the goal fixated as such, to remember the journey is actually part of it. Don't try and understand everything all at once. Use your words, practice in the slogans, like try and capture things with words. Apply the teachings to your own situation rather than just intellectual stimulation. And question, question, question. So the Socratic questioning and follow-up is like running a fire drill. What happens if this happens? What happens if that? Then what do I do? What if this went this way or that way? So that's the ones in general, but in particular for Tantra, to become a student of Tantra, the wish to be liberated. So we need to have an understanding of renunciation, a genuine wish wanting to develop renunciation, if not having already developed renunciation. And even if our renunciation is unstable, to continue to work on it. To be able to, unable to bear the suffering of others without actually helping them. So bodhicitta, putting our empathy into action, taking a sense of responsibility. Confidence in the Vajra Master. So your mind and the mind of the Vajra Master are harmonious, they're in accord. You want to guard the vows. You have confidence in Tantra. You've trained in the preliminaries. You can meet the commitments and you can't wait to meet the commitments. And then actually requesting the initiation. So there is a formal little part at the beginning of an initiation where there is someone who requests, but we all do a mandala offering. So that's the request from the heart that we make. So any questions or comments about this? Our responsibility as a student. They can be quite demanding.
Don't do that, right?
Yes. So generally the highest yoga tantra commitments are more demanding than the lower tantra ones. And believe it or not, what I've found is that the bigger the initiation, like highest yoga tantra, the more famous, the more razzle dazzle associated with it, the more people come, and then they're shocked. What? You mean I actually have to practice this thing? So it's real spiritual materialism that happens. Whereas, oh, just a little initiation, oh, it's just, you know, wisdom or just compassion or something like that, and all you have to do is say, Om Mani Padme Hum, 100 times a day, then people are like, oh, yeah. So the thing is, the initiation is like the beginning of a practice. So we wouldn't take it if we weren't interested in the practice.
But you do have to maintain
yourself. You do, yep. You do. That said, I've fallen off the wagon many times, and then I've tried to purify. And so I remember after doing like a bunch of eight nyungnays up at Chenrezig Institute, and Venerable Sering said to me, now, if you can't just keep breaking your commitments and thinking you can come up here and do eight nyungnays in a row and fix it, you actually have to keep your commitments. Because it's like saying, oh, you know, well, I break my leg, it can heal again. It's like, it's better not to break your leg in the first place. So depending on the level of the initiation, yes, they are. Yep. And so when we get into the three gates, we'll have a look at that, what those vows are. But so the most of the vows you can find out beforehand, and they're things that you want to keep because they help us live well, kindly, wisely. So they're not onerous. They're actually something wonderful to have. So I remember actually one time when Geshe Toshi Sering gave an initiation in Bendigo, and the commitment was to do Guru Yoga. So this practice of the blessing of the white Om, the red Ah, the blue Hum each day. And so someone at the end of the initiation asked, well, I already have to do this for a different practice. Do I have to do it for this practice too? Oh my God, everyone else just hung their head in shame, and Kishla's like, why did you take this initiation if you don't want to practice it? That's the highest yoga tantra initiation for the tantric vows. You don't really find out those vows till then. Yep. And the commitment also will depend on the lama. And so sometimes a commitment can be you have to do a retreat, or you have to say, or you can do X amount of mantras each day for the rest of your life. You take this or this, you have a choice. Other times it's you have to do the retreat and you have to do the mantras. It all depends. But what is guaranteed is whatever they say, it's because it's beneficial for us. It's like medicine. It's like if you want to get cured of cancer, if you want to get cured of samsara, this is the medicine you have to take. So I might use that as an example, but you know, we're pretty bad at taking medicine too, aren't we? So we'll come to what the particular commitments are with the three gates of tantra, three gates to enter. So then the qualities of the master in sutra are divided into three: conduct, wisdom, and the method of looking after students. So the conduct, ethical discipline, meditative stabilization, training and wisdom. So that's the three higher trainings. And right there, you know, it points out that the lama has to act well, act kindly. It's no good having a lama saying, everybody has to act kindly, and then the lama is abusing others. Then that's a double standard, not acceptable. Wisdom, be able to accurately quote scripture, have at least conceptually realized emptiness, and to know more than the student about the particular topic, not about everything, but just about that topic. And how to look after students, having some skill in teaching. So you'll notice how the lamas always throw in a joke, especially when everyone's feeling really sleepy, or a story. Motivated by love, not necessarily money, or even by accolade or getting good feedback. Being content with one's work, and in particular content to repeat things again and again and again and again. Patient and tolerant, especially with difficult people. So if anybody, you know, if someone, I mean, any kind of teacher who favours the goodies and wants to get rid of the disruptors or the unwashed or whatever it is, then warning bells. So in Tantra, though, then there's extra. At the very least, the qualities now must have more qualities than faults. So instead of just more qualities than the student, now it's the collection of qualities has to be more than the collection of faults. That they have attained the empowerment from a qualified master, so they have this pure lineage. They themselves are abiding the vows and samayas, so they haven't broken their own commitments. They're holding clean, pure commitments that they can then pass on to us. They are learned in the lineage rites, so it's not just academic, but the actual practice of everything, the mandalas, the dispelling interferences, all the initiations, the offerings, the tormas, the lot, the commentaries, the ear-whispered lineage. They've done the retreat, so that's usually the three-year retreat. And they have permission from the deity to confer the empowerment, or at the very least, no negative signs, not opposed by the deity. So it's a big deal. It's not like in the West where people, you know, you learn once, show once, you know, share once or whatever it is, how it's passed on. What's that saying?
Again.
Yeah, there's some saying. So that you know, you watch someone do something, you give it a go yourself, and then you teach somebody else.
Oh, you then to repeat.
To repeat it, yeah. So this kind of thing, it's fine if you're learning cooking, but it's not going to work with tantric practice. It's a lot more stringent. How do we see the signs? So how we can check? You check with the conduct of their students. So then we still have to verify. If we're going down to Bendigo and we don't know the Vajra Master, we still have to verify. So if it's someone like Lama Zorob Rinpoche, you know, or, I mean, occasionally there are touring lamas as well, so you can find out. You can go to their YouTube clips. You can find out what their students say, what their Facebook page is like, what's the conduct of their students, how they treat each other, how they support each other, what their centers are like. So that's one. So to actually see, is the effect that teacher is having on the students a positive, beneficial effect, or is everyone just nuts and fighting? Yes, but we can verify that really easily, or we can just go and visit, or we can, you know, visit a Facebook page and see how skillful are people. You can ask other people that have been, involved, but then you've also got to be careful who you ask, because people have different criteria. So people have criteria of someone is famous. That's a really big deal. Or you should go, they're really famous. Or they have charisma, or they've made movies, or all sorts of things like that. So check the students. Then you check what do their peers say about them. So what do other lamas say about that lama, their peers? So what does Khandrala say about Lama Zorob Rinpoche? What does Lama Zorob Rinpoche say about Khandrala? What does His Holiness the Dalai Lama say about Lama Zorob Rinpoche? That's a really good way to check. Then the Lama themselves, do they big note themselves, or do they say, like Lama Zorob Rinpoche does, I'm just a Mickey Mouse Lama? So that's a kind of a tradition in Tibet where they... and maybe a Buddhist tradition where you don't big note yourself, you talk yourself down. But also many Western scientists will do that too. They'll say the more we study this, the less we know. So that is a good sign. Whereas if you come across someone, oh, and then you ask, fourth thing, who are their gurus? How do they talk about their gurus? Do they talk about their gurus with respect? So I notice, like, when Geshe Zopa talks about his guru, he says, my late master, with such humility. It's not like my guru, like spiritual materialism, I've got six of them on a shelf. No, he's like my master. He's put himself below. It's a huge, big difference. Whereas sometimes when I hear people talk about, oh, I've taken teachings off this person or that person, or this person's my guru too and that person's my guru, I get really cringy and I try to figure out why. And why? It's like collecting cats or something, you know. It's just like, it's just wrong. So how do they talk about their guru?
Not being done, are they?
No, they're not being done in person, but we're in a real tipping time now because, like, His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave that Chenrezig initiation online, and it is there. We can retake it.
Yeah.
We're going to retake it before we do our Christmas Nyungnays. So, you know, it's extraordinary. So it doesn't mean that it's the end of an era like that. But yes, it's very difficult to have a tantric initiation from a qualified teacher, a perfectly qualified Mahayana guru. You might have imperfectly qualified Mahayana gurus that maybe have some of these things, but might have a pride thing of big noting themselves or expecting accolades. So not perfect, still highly educated and... It's a changing situation because there has been the whole fallout, for instance, from Dagri Rinpoche that was associated with FPMT, who abused and molested several people. And so it wasn't at an FPMT center, as far as I can tell, but he was an FPMT Lama. So not perfectly qualified Mahayana guru. But nevertheless, he gave initiation here, and he gave a very powerful initiation, and it was really interesting because the teaching that he gave wasn't so strong, but the initiation was. So that's like this, the practitioner is there, but the surrounding rest of the package was weak. But from our point of view, from my point of view, having taken initiation from him, the way that I see it is that that's the weakness of my karmic vision. My karma is to have an imperfect Mahayana guru manifest to me. That's the weakness of my vision. So it's quite, you can be quite clear in your mind then. You don't have to have you don't lose your samaya that way. You can say, okay, this is an example of how never to act something that's not acceptable and is a double standard. And this is my teaching of exactly what it looks like without losing your guru devotion. But it's a tricky thing to negotiate, especially if it's happened to you. It's very traumatic. And it's traumatic because often the approach that we have to a guru is really infantile, of just completely abdicating any responsibility from our side as a student. Yes, but no, you don't need to have, you know, perfectly developed renunciation. You can even just have a wish for renunciation, Ian. That's okay.
Just practice, everything develops.
So. It does. In fact, I started off with, I wish I had a wish for renunciation. You know, I'm just hanging on by my fingernails there. Yes, Bev. I mean, that's why we have purification practices, because we do stuff up. And so part of even taking refuge, part of the refuge commitments is to know what to do when you have a downfall, when you break a vow or you weaken a vow. Part of it is to know how to fix it. That's part of the package. You get the fix-it kit with the refuge. So it's given, of course we're not perfect, that's why we need these vows.
and to break them fully, like you need
a whole lot of things in there to break them fully, yeah.
It's hard.
We're unnaturally cautious here at Langri Tampa Centre.
Yeah.
I think overly cautious in a way, but we'll get to that at the end of how to make, what's this balance? Am I ready? Am I cautious? What's the balance? So the four bodies of a Buddha, remember the whole thing with the tantric path is that we need the substantial cause. So we have the body of a Buddha and the mind of a Buddha. And when we become enlightened, you know, we achieve both simultaneously. And to actually achieve this, we need the substantial cause. So we need practices that are similar, you know, to the result in each of these things. So the practices on wisdom are the ones that result in the purified, enlightened mind. But the substantial cause, the practices for the purified body of a Buddha can only be found in Tantra. That's what's unique. There are no substantial causes anywhere else except in Tantra. And we need to have both simultaneously. So often what we'll talk about is on one side, you know, the Dharmakaya, and that includes the nature truth, the nature body and the truth body, but we generally just say Dharmakaya. And then on the other side we have Sambhogakaya, the enjoyment body, and Nimanakaya, the emanation body. So what we're most familiar with is the emanation body, the person of the guru. His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Geshe Zopa and Geshe Tashi Sering. And also what's part of Nimanakaya are the various statues and the tankas. What we very, very rarely see is the Sambhogakaya, the actual light body of a Buddha. And in a way, that's what you could think of as the personality of a Buddha. All the different manifestations to help others. Though I think people see Sambhogakaya, the light body of a Buddha, maybe in dreams, in visions. We have the approximation of it in our meditation session. So the substantial causes, so the substantial cause of Buddhahood, so the substantial cause of a Buddha's wisdom, all the meditations on emptiness, wisdom realizing emptiness. The substantial cause of a Buddha's activity and a Buddha's forms, what's that? What do you reckon?
Life.
Life, yep. What sort of life? What do we do?
Light.
Yes, Dean, that's right. So the Buddha's activity. So what does a Buddha do? Yeah, what does a Buddha do?
Teach.
Teach is one, yep. What else? Run around driving cars, cook dinner. No, what does a Buddha do? Dean had it.
Enlightens light.
Enlightens. Emanates lights. Continuously. And at the end of each light beam are countless other little Buddhas doing the works for sentient beings like fiber optics. So a Buddha doesn't even, and when a Buddha teaches, like in the Heart Sutra, the Buddha didn't even say anything. It was a conversation between Chenrezig and who? Shariputra? Yes, that's right. A network, which is consciousness, because wherever a Buddha's mind pervades all, wherever a Buddha's mind is, a Buddha's body is. Not separate. So yes, it's like a network of light.
Information.
Light is information. Very nice. Fiber optics. That's right. So that's the Buddha's manifold forms. And information can be infinite, can't it? Continuous. Just like you have the alphabet, you can get an infinite amount of words from that. So you have your mantras and an infinite amount of activities from that. That's right. Everyone's connected and we are not separate from that. We're not separate from the Dharmakaya. The nature of our mind is the same as the nature of the Buddha's mind. So it's not like me here and the Buddha there. Not separate. So even though we feel separate because we're so disconnected, so that's what all those practices are about, unification with the deity, with the guru, to redress the balance and get more in line with reality. So how we do that in the sadhana are the four complete results of a Buddha. So to the result of a Buddha's abode, so the environment and the body. So it's not like the body and the abode are separate. You know, there's within and without. The form and the mandala, they're all the Buddha. So meditations on the mandala to as the substantial cause for the environment of a Buddha. Meditations on the form of a Buddha as a substantial cause for us being able to arise as a Buddha into these manifold forms. Making offerings is the substantial cause for all of the enjoyments and the resources, the infinite resources of a Buddha, to be able to help sentient beings in whatever way they need. And as Dean said, the lights, so emanating and absorbing lights is what the Buddha does, the deeds of a Buddha. And this is the one where I think of it, this is almost like how like breathing as a Buddha. That you send out infinite lights as, liberating all sentient beings. Those lights absorb back into your heart and regenerate. Then breathe out all of the beautiful offerings to now all the sentient beings that are enlightened. And the lights absorb back into your heart with all the blessings and the energy of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So it's this continuous activity where you never run out of energy. So every tantric sadhana will have these four aspects in it, but some are not obvious. So lots of the little short sadhanas, they don't have any mandala at all. They don't have the abode for a Buddha. So what do you think, what's part of that? How do we cover that one? How do we make sure that we've got a complete...
Just do the
mandala. No, the mandala offering is different. That's an offering. No, the mandala, the abode, the actual universe of a Buddha. So what do we do with those sadhanas where there is no imagining of the mandala with all the Buddhas in it, you know, like with the mandala house and yes, but that's not the meditation on it. So Geshe Thachi Sering said what the workaround for this is in a sadhana at the end where you offer the tormas. The traumas are to the front generation, and the front generation is always there in the mandala. And so that's the little tenuous making sure that you're doing the meditation on the mandala, and then it's there. So you've got the form, that you know, the arising as the deity, making the offerings, saying the mantra, emanating lights. That's pretty much always there in the sadhana, but the abode isn't necessarily there, and that's why you have the trauma offering at the end. And the torma offering is always to the front generation, and specifically to quickly hasten realizations. So it really energizes your practice. So that one, the mandala, can be implicit or explicit. Then we've got three gates to enter Tantra. So this is like, remember, going to get to the inner sanctum. Vajradhara there in the castle, you have to enter through three gates. And really what this answers is, do you have to be Buddhist to practice Tantra? To have an initiation, whether you've taken refuge previously or not, you will take refuge in the initiation. That's part of it. And you will retake refuge, kind of reinvigorate it anyway during the initiation. So that's number one. And what's refuge? The door to? The gate to? What is it open? No. No. What's refuge? Open the lands of?
The Buddha.
The Buddha. So you become a Buddhist by taking refuge. The gate to the Mahayana, bodhicitta. So not everybody passes through that gate, the bodhicitta gate. Many stay in the lands of the Buddha, of refuge. But then we get a little bit closer with bodhicitta. And so bodhicitta, the vows, they're depending on what type of initiation, aspiring bodhicitta or engaging bodhicitta. So the aspiring one, the wish to develop bodhicitta, like that prayer that we did at the beginning of the class, or engaging bodhicitta, the 18 vows and the 46 auxiliary vows. And so they're vows that you can study and read about and find out about, and they're there in your notes. And then empowerment. That's the gate to mantra. And so necessarily you have some form of bodhicitta during that empowerment. You can't go, oh, I'm just doing this empowerment for me, I'm not ready to help other sentient beings. No, 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 no. and so then you get there, and the whole way that you get there is like meeting the maestro, the guru, the root of the path, unifying oneself with a source of inspiration. And part of that is continuous guru yoga practices of like immersing yourself in those qualities of the guru. And remembering that the guru is a lot more than the person of the guru. So you have the person of the guru, which is mind-blowing in itself, like just being in the presence of Geshe Zopa or Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you know, or His Holiness, it's mind-blowing. And, you know, people find themselves spontaneously weeping and having various dreams and epiphanies and all sorts of things. So there is something that really happens when someone with realizations teaches us. It's completely different from just someone parroting something or reading from a book. And actually, like even when you go to Dharma teachings, the criteria of good Dharma teachings isn't if it was a good presentation, or even if they can lead well, or, you know, even if they stuff up the puja or whatever it is. The thing is, are they genuine practitioners? That is the number one criteria. So you can't have someone that's not a practitioner lead something just because they can say pronounce the words well or something. It's just not going to work. Or if it does, everything might go smoothly and it just makes no dint in the students' minds whatsoever. What actually makes a difference is this real authenticity, as with everything. And different types of guru. So I think the main thing for me about this was to not think, oh, I need to spend lots of time with my guru. We just need to actually be moved once or twice in our life, and that may be enough. So, I mean, my root guru is Lama Yeshe, and he passed away in 1984, but I still feel close to Lama Yeshe. And because when he passed away, I was still a teenager, and because Lama Yeshe had said, you know, I'm your teacher in this life and all future lives until, you know, you're all enlightened, then I thought, well, there's no way he's going to ever abandon us. So just because he leaves this body, not to worry. And I couldn't understand why everybody was so sad. So then Lama Zopa Rinpoche, there's photographs of him there at the funeral. with a really, really sad face. So then I was like, wow, so you still have the full gamut of human experience, but you experience it as an enlightened being. Just like the Buddha lived the life of a human being, but going through those motions of becoming a Buddha. Well, I mean, the interesting thing about Lama Zorpa Rinpoche was that when Lama Eshi died, then Lama Zorpa Rinpoche started taking on the personality characteristics of Lama Eshi. So Lama Eshi used to be the big, extroverted, funny, telling amazing stories, super charismatic. And Lama Zorpa Rinpoche was really serious and really heavy and really shy and just talked about hell and suffering for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And so people either gravitated towards one or the other. And then when Lama Eshi died, then Lama Zorpa Rinpoche kind of turned into Lama Eshi. So then he's kind of both. So in my mind, I don't even see a difference. And because he was so devoted to Lama Eshi. And so... Well, yes. And then Lama Zorpa Rinpoche is a Lama Yeshi's student. So when Venerable Rabina teaches, it's almost like she channels Lama Yeshi, and Lama Yeshi was her root guru. And sometimes it's like Lama Yeshi speaking through her. And when Geshe Zopa teaches, sometimes it's like Lama Zorpa Rinpoche speaking through him. It's just extraordinary. So there's a real continuity there, this lineage that's palpable. But nevertheless, we do need to have a day-to-day mentor. We do need to have someone that we can ask questions with and confer with and actually get advice from an experienced practitioner. And then we need to have, like us, a Dharma community where we can talk on the same page. Instead of having people say, why are you wasting your time with that? So we have the maestro, the guru, and then the initiation. So what exactly is an initiation? Initiation is the first experience of you being the deity provided by the Vajra Master. So it's like planting the seed for you to actually have that experience yourself, to grow into that experience. So it's like hearing the whole symphony instead of just one tiny little phrase. So if you've gone to a symphony, you might come out of it and you might actually be able to sing like two bars and it's going through your head, but it's pretty hard to sing four bars or even six. But the two are there and you've got the whole thing ringing in your mind. So the initiation can go for a very long time because everything's in there. And then when you go back and you do the practice, it's like you slot back into that. It's like that movie's continuously going and you slot back into it till it becomes clearer and clearer. And so I left this in because Sue said that she found it really a nice way of putting it, the three principal aspects of the path. So you renunciation, you leave aside your misconceptions and you replace them with a spirit of freedom, wishing to be free from samsara, both the ups and the downs, both the downs and the ups, a yearning for freedom. Then a mind possessed by universal altruism, bodhicitta. And really, I've been thinking about this just the last few days because of Geshe Zopa's teaching, that often we start caring about others when their suffering becomes really apparent to us, when it's the suffering of suffering. But very rarely do we have an equal amount of compassion for the suffering of change, of happiness, or just the all-pervasive suffering. Those are less obvious. So we tend to just, you know, care about those that overtly look like they're suffering or oppressed and don't feel so warmly or care so much about the oppressors. And then the correct view. So we understand how the tantric reality corresponds more to our fundamental Buddha nature than our own current limited identity. Our own current view of the world is fundamentally flawed. And yet it's just like we're driven by habit, ordinary appearances every time. And then the initiation itself. Two types of empowerment. So this is a part where I find everybody gets really confused. And it's because it doesn't necessarily happen in order. But a full initiation is called a great initiation, a wang. And then generally after that are lots of little what are called subsequent permissions, jenangs. But sometimes what happens is a lama will visit and will be requested to give initiation, like say Vajrasattva here or Tara or Chenrezig, and it will be a jenang. It will be a subsequent permission. And that may be the very first one that you have. So how are you going to figure it out? What's your strategy? Thank you, Bev. You ask. And who are you going to ask? That's right. Ask the lama, the person organizing it, the SPC. Don't ask the person sitting next to you. No. Because you're likely to get, like, just depending which side you ask, totally different answers. Don't even necessarily ask the sangha, because some sangha may be very new sangha and they may not know. They themselves may not have had an initiation. So you could ask the translator, the attendant, the lama, the organizer, the SPC. Yep.
And these are the commitments.
Yes, so many times the lamas would tour and they'd say come along because you could attend like a blessing with no commitment, but then you couldn't self-generate. And then also many times the translator or the lama just wouldn't say all those bits. And actually Geshe Tashi Sering is quite unusual in how he would itemize everything and explain everything. And we're doing this now, and this is what you imagine, and this is what you feel, and this is what it purifies, and this is what the result will be. Amazing. That's really unique to have that kind of depth. And so then also because many of the organizers may not have known what on earth was going on either. I know I didn't. So then they wouldn't know what to put for commitments or anything. So yeah, nowadays we've become more educated, thank goodness. And less kind of flippant about it, I suppose. So it's really worth finding out. And then remember, so Ben, your question, I'm still laughing about your question about, you know, if you have a tantric initiation but then you don't self-generate, is that okay? And I'm still thinking, how are we manifesting today? It's like Lama Yeshe was talking about, how are you interpreting yourself today? So we're always self-generating. And so we've just got to pick the very best way that we can self-generate. So even if you have a jenang and you can't self-generate as the deity and you have the deity in front, at least what you bring to the fore is all of your virtues, and you generate, you self-generate as a person developing the three principal aspects of the path with all these virtues. And if we have had the initiation and we do have the permission to self-generate, then it's kind of like, do we want to generate as our miserable person? Or as an infinitely blissful, capable Buddha? And if we have the sadhana, then we don't have to be scared because everything's in there. All the the formula, the recipe, refuge, bodhicitta, going through, it's all there, even if it's quite quick. So as long as we follow the instructions, it'll work out well. But even then, like I know a couple of people might have gone up to Chenrezig Institute to do the Nyungnaes just recently and didn't quite get it, that they'd had the Chenrezig initiation, so then they could self-generate and they actually must use all of the implements because it's a lower tantra, and part of lower tantra is physically disciplining the body. So I didn't quite put it together. So I went up to Chenrezig Institute, did the Nyungnaes, I think self-generated as Chenrezig, but didn't do any of the other things. So it takes a long time for all the pieces to fall into place. So with the tantric path, we're using desire as the fuel. So we're not turning desire, the afflictive desire. We're using the experience, a pleasant experience, as fuel to become enlightened instead of as fuel for more samsara. So ordinary pleasure, ordinary pleasant sensations in a samsaric way narrow our attention, increase our dissatisfaction, are increasingly neurotic. Any kind of pleasant experience from the tantric point of view, when it's informed with those three principal aspects of the path, expands the mind, opens the heart, overcomes limitations. It's completely different. So this wonderful quote, when the intense energy of bliss is focused on emptiness, it gives rise to the wisdom that cuts the root of suffering. So we need to have a really intense consciousness to cut that root of suffering, to meditate on emptiness. So if we have that energy and momentum of extreme bliss and focus that on emptiness, then it is literally dynamite. But just like anything, it takes a lot to harness that kind of power. So the way that we can tell with harnessing that power is those four classes of action, the four classes of tantra. How much of a good time, how much blissful energy can you harness before you go berserk? So action tantra takes the kind of joy that you get from gazing at the beloved. You have the photo of the beloved, and discipline mostly by external activity. So this is Nyungnae practice, and that's the one that we're most familiar with. And so a whole lot of those, the external activities of the keeping clean and watching the diet and using the bell and dorji. And then that way, slowly the mind starts also being tamed. Performance tantra, the ability to handle the type of joy that comes from gazing at the beloved and exchanging glances, smiling back and forth. Yoga tantra, being able to take the joy of gazing at the beloved, smiling back and forth, and holding hands or embrace. So these are kind of universal experiences and that we can relate to. And then highest yoga tantra, the highest capacity, being able to take all of those plus the bliss of union onto the path, that type of blissful energy, to harness that type of energy in meditation and take it onto the path without just blissing out, without going, oh, this is good, I want more. So the thing about using bliss on the path. The analogy is it's like a vaccine, because we're not actually taking, even though it's called the desire, taking practices containing desire, actually technically it's not practices containing desire, it's containing the energy of desire, because desire is an affliction. So we're not taking an afflicted mind onto the path. So it's kind of like a vaccine. So vaccine uses disease to produce medicine. What ensures it won't kill us? It's processed well. And what do we process it well with? The empty view and altruism. And so then we use the bliss arising from desire to counter the affliction. We use the medicine to counter the disease. And it's quite different from Mahayana Sutra, because Tantra does not eliminate the energy of affliction. It harnesses it. So most of the time we are used to countering our negative, our afflictions, to subduing them, to making sure that we don't express them. So it's a counterforce. Whereas this is not a counterforce. We're actually taking that energy and running with it. It's completely different. Focusing it, harnessing it. So it's ironic, you know, we're using this example of a vaccine now that there's so many anti-vaxxers. I'm like, oh no. And there's a whole lot of fear. So one of the things that I read about the fear of people are saying no one who's got a vaccine is allowed in this shop. And I'm like, why would you want someone who's banned someone who's vaccinated? It's because of fear that you might be shedding the virus from the vaccine. So this is like not even understanding how vaccines work, how it's like it takes the sting out of the tail, it takes the affliction out of it to heal us. So that that disease, is actually processed through all sorts of ways to whatever you call it, denature it, I suppose. And that's exactly what happens with this too. But, you know, no wonder we're in trouble as a society. And, I mean, it just comes from, we've got to really just sit down and educate ourselves. And the same thing with Tantra too, that we have to really educate ourselves and not be frightened of the energy. But have just made sure that we've got that due process, that we've processed it well, that we can rely on our renunciation and our bodhicitta. So questions about this, about either the four classes of Tantra or about this analogy, like a vaccine? Yeah, so, but that's when the mind is pacified, then it washes over you. But what about if, say, just for a mundane example, say someone criticizes you and you know, and it's unwarranted criticism. Don't you get this idea? Don't you get galvanized to go, I'll show you. I'll show you the opposite. I'll prove you wrong. So that's like harnessing that energy of the criticism to create some virtue, to do a good thing, to prove them wrong. No, you're not going, oh, well, that doesn't matter. That, you know, they said they criticized me and it's not true, so why worry? That's pacifying. But the other one is like, you know, you're a loser, you'll never be able to do anything. You go, oh, yes, I will, and off you go. And you use all of that to galvanize you. And it puts a rocket under you. It is. That's why it's tricky. Desire is always linked to attachment. So just like, you know, anger is an energy and desire is an energy, but because it is completely linked with the worldly concerns and linked with our preoccupation with appearances, believing appearances, it's linked with all of our senses. So, you know, it comes from outside of us. And then that way we miss it. We've got all of this energy and we can't harness it. It just goes to create more samsara. Yeah, and yet if we could take so much more, you know, anger is an energy, yes, But bliss also is an energy. What if we could harness that? And then everything that we do, we're galvanized and we're joyous. So the whole thing with this is to actually, the blissful mind activating the actual feeling of bliss and all of the subtle energies in your body, so that you have a feeling of bliss and your mind becomes blissful, and then that focuses on emptiness. So that's much more powerful than just intellectually talking about emptiness, much more powerful than just calmly thinking about emptiness. It just burns through delusions. Just like, you know, if someone does criticize you and you go, right, I'll show them. You have adrenaline surging through your body. You have a physiological response. You have energy. You know, you're not about to just lie down and have a little nap. You know,
it's also pull that 3 days later.
And have it come up again. That's right. Just from remembering it, recalling it 3 days later. So, yeah, it's a very powerful harnessing the energy in our body, and not just our coarse body, but our subtle body. So the type of bliss from tantric meditation is far more blissful than any kind of physical sexuality. Physical sexuality is like a pale approximation. It's just like a hint at it. And it's actually because the winds in the central channel, they brush past the central channel. And so we get a little approximation of what that feeling is like when the winds actually enter the central channel. So, but because all we're used to is just sex, drugs, and rock and roll, we think that's it. Like, that's just like a world lived in black and white, sepia. Yeah, because sexuality is mostly based on our coarse body.
So if that's the case, why?
The type of bliss that's similar. So this is the type of joy that arises,
right,
from, for instance, you know, gazing back and forth and holding hands, embrace and union. So the reason why in any kind of sex that we have a good feeling is because our subtle body is going through experiences and the winds are just brushing close to the central channel. And then we have a momentary experience of bliss and then it passes. So it's similar. This is the analogy, this one. Yeah, that's kind of sexual union's like the pinnacle for a materialist, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because it's physical based, it's based on the senses, you know, it's dependent on external things and circumstances, all of that kind of thing, but very fleeting, unsustainable. Yeah, that's right. People act badly, and you're very forgiving, and all of this. That's right. Your honeymoon period, rose-colored glasses. But even so, even like this, if you try having sex for like 18 hours, you're going to be in pain. Yeah. So that's because it's based on the physical thing, on the coarse body. It's not built for that. So, but in meditation, if you're actually working with these subtle energies, and even if you just have a little taste of that, which people do with sex or drugs or rock and roll, and then, of course, then your mind is blown, but hardly ever do you think in that experience, now I'm going to meditate on emptiness. So the other time that this happens is during the death process, because in the death process, then all of our coarse body starts disintegrating and shutting down and stops being a distraction. And what's left is more and more subtle. So then we have a chance too with clear light mind to meditate on emptiness. But only if that's our preoccupation on a very deep level. Yes, okay. So then we do the retreat. The retreat is actually called the approach, approaching the deity. We put it into practice. So the whole thing is a lot more than just learning about it. It's actually got to be practiced. Just like it's no good reading a cookbook. You do start by reading the cookbook. It's actually handy if you do read the recipe from the beginning to the end before you start. I've watched those shows, and I've watched them how the cooking shows. I've been watching Zumbo's Last Desserts or something, and they're making all these outrageous desserts, but they get in such a fluster that they don't pre-read the recipe before they go off and do it. And then they get three quarters of the way through and go, oh no, stuffed up. So it is good for us to do a course like this and to actually do some research and to go from the beginning to the end in our research. But that's not enough. We have to do the practice. We have to have the actual taste of it and start putting it together in our experience. The external world and the internal world seem so different. And we've got to start kind of bridging that. I think that's the key to staying happy in our practice. Because if it's all intellectual and we don't actually do the practice or the meditation, we'll just get grumpy and impatient and burn out. And one of the saddest things is to see really intelligent Dharma students bickering. You know, that's a bad sign. It'd actually be much better to have just really humble Dharma students that just know a few things but actually care for each other. I think, you know, that's much more sustainable. And Geshe Zopa, and I think also Geshe Sherab was saying in the monasteries, you know, the ones that the people that study hard, and everyone just thinks they'll go places. They're a star student. And they're the ones that often end up disrobing, not sustainable. And just the other day on the Sunday night teaching, Geshe Zopa was saying, you know, like it's tough being a Dharma practitioner, it's tough being a monk and having all of the commitments and, you know, then all of his teaching commitments and all the things that you give up. So how do you keep that sustainable? It's got to come from within. It's not going to come from everybody else clapping you and cheering you on. And just as a sideline too, what I found, say, with doing the Nyungna is because that's really the only, you know, practice or retreat that I do, and it's been a while now since COVID. But so Christmas, New Year, and then Easter. And it's great because it's such an immersive, intense experience. So it really is like boot camp, and that suits me very, very well. And what I found was amazing was from year to year, you'd sit down on the cushion and you'd do the first session and everything would come back. It's like you'd pick up from where you left off. It hadn't faded. You know, the realizations, the understanding was there, and each time it got more and more rich and amazing. It's almost like there's a parallel reality there, and we're crazy not to dip into it as much as possible and bring it into our day-to-day. So all the different types of retreat, if you're going to do a Lamrim retreat, try and make sure that you marry it with some guru yoga or deity practice to supercharge it. And from mid-year, so at the end of this term, after our mid-year break, then our retreat room becomes available for Langri Tampa Centre members if you want to come and do a retreat for a weekend or, you know, possibly a week or something like that, and actually do a retreat here on holy ground on site with a curated book list from me and Eddie, and help to set up the altar and to plan the retreat, then that's there for members. So it's really nice. It's a really nice place. And at the back of the property there, it's really quiet, except for the possums. And they're like thunder. So then the question, but am I ready? So this is our summary. So with Tantra, you don't actually have to understand it for it to work. So all of this that we've been talking about, we don't actually have to understand it. We just have to do the practice and it'll work. Just like you don't have to understand digestion for you to be able to digest dinner. It's handy if you understand digestion, but it's not the essential thing. The essential thing is the having the dinner and digesting. So as long as we follow the instructions and do the practice, it's guaranteed we'll get the result. So Tantra is rare. I mean, the Buddha Dharma is rare, but Tantra is even rarer still. So they say the appearance of a Buddha is more rare than a star seen in the daytime. A star in broad daylight. And you know, I mean, the last time that we saw a star in broad daylight was when Jesus was born, wasn't it? 2,000 years ago. Doesn't happen that often. So that's the appearance of a Buddha, incredibly rare. So the 1,000 Buddhas of this fortunate eon. So you know the hats that the lamas wear look a little bit like centurion hats, the yellow ones. So that top bit, it's got a 1,000 threads. That's what it's made up of, and they're all kind of sewn together. And they represent the 1,000 Buddhas of this fortunate eon. So Shakyamuni Buddha is number 4. Maitreya Buddha is going to be number 5. Very interesting, because Maitreya Buddha is always depicted sitting on a chair. So they say of the 1,000 Buddhas of this fortunate eon, only one will teach Tantra, Shakyamuni Buddha. And we're in this eon, of this fortunate eon, we're right here. They say the last one, number 1,000, will teach what everybody else taught, so possibly 2 Buddhas. So beyond rare. And then here we are in all the 6 realms. We're in the human realm. Out of all the 7 billion human beings, we've met the Dharma, we've met Tantra, we've got leisure and opportunity. We are the leisured classes, whatever way you look at it. And not only that, like in the time from, we are still in the time of the Buddha, but from when the Buddha was walking this earth to now, for us women, this is probably the only time, the only 30, 40 years of time where we've had a window of opportunity, protection,
yeah.
The ability to live alone, to earn your own wage, we don't have to go run away into a cave, all of those things. Like even that, in narrowing it down, it's becoming more and more and more and more extraordinary. So we've got this precious opportunity. So we've got to balance that with, wow, I'm here now. You know, with, I don't feel ready. And so we can't actually wait till we feel ready, because we'll die. We'll die before we feel ready. That's just how it is. It's like waiting for Godot. So how we have to actually make an informed decision. How do we know if we're ready? Because we're not going to feel ready. Just like people become parents. Do they ever feel ready? Where we find ourselves, as Rinpoche says, it seems impossible, yet it happened. So this is amazing. It's like we have this inheritance. This is extraordinary. We should be beyond jumping for joy. So, yeah, of course, you have an inheritance, it's a responsibility, but within that is jumping for joy, is just being so happy. How fortunate are we? How extraordinary. So this is how we have to make the decision. We can't make the decision from a worldly Dharma point of view, because we won't come up with the right answer. So this way we can make a decision. We'll know when our renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view are stable enough for us to embark, considering this is it. So where to from here? There is the DVD on Tantra. On our website, under the resources tab, there's a watch and listen part. And in there, I've collated all of the Discovering Buddhism DVDs in the one place. It took me hours to find because they're all over YouTube, but some are in Russian and some are this and that. So I found them all and they're all there. So you can find the Tantra one. And next week we're going to do the From Afflictions to Perfections, the board game. Has anyone here not played that game? Dean, come along next week. It's a board game that I invented, and I even produced it and cut all the corners of all of the cards, but it's a conversational game. So
you learn
stuff. It's heaps of fun. And because Lama Yeshe used to want, at the end of each study unit, to have like a public exam. And of course, everyone will run screaming from the room at the mention of that. At Chenrezig Institute, they used to have one side of the room question the other side of the room, but even that was too traumatic for people. So what we have is a game. And then in July, we start with Unit 1 again, Mind and Its Potential, with Eddie. How? Yep, continuing here. But it'll be Eddie here and me there with the online people. So it'll be a little bit better for the online people because they'll be able to ask questions as they go. So let's gather all of our efforts, our good-heartedness, our aspirations, and all of the energy from this entire course, everything that we've heard, may it come to fruition. All of the effort that we've put in, may it come to fruition. May we be able to seize the day, this incredible opportunity to really appreciate what we have, that our appreciation can give us energy. And may we accomplish the great task of being able to liberate all sentient beings from suffering, because we have the capability to do so. And we can't bear the thought of either ourselves or anybody else continuing to circle up and down continuously forever in samsara. So dedicating our efforts that we may take this incredibly quick path, this almost magical quick path, the lightning vehicle, to be able to, as they say, quickly enlighten all sentient beings, liberate them from samsara, give breath to the wretched, to those unable to breathe. And may we be able to do it in this very lifetime. And if not in this very lifetime, then at this very death time when we're dying, may we call on our guru and be able to accomplish this great task for the benefit of all. So there are empowerments at all four classes of Tantra? Yes, there are. And when an empowerment is advertised or going to be given, they will say what level of Tantra it is. So, for instance, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama was giving the Great Chenrezig Initiation online, so that was clearly stated as being a great initiation, Chenrezig, in the lower Tantra, and over 2 days, and Bodhisattva vows, and a commitment. So, as Bev was saying in the class, nowadays the advertising is a lot more clear, and what our responsibilities are as students is a lot more spelled out than it has previously been in the West. So generally though, the initiations that are offered are usually either Action Tantra, which is the lower Tantra, or highest yoga tantra. And it's very rare that there's the middle two that are given nowadays. So the only one for the second level, performance tantra, was the Miktukpa initiation that Lama Zopa Rinpoche gave up at Chenrezig Institute quite a few years ago. But otherwise, it's been the lower tantras. So Medicine Buddha, Chenrezig, White Tara, Green Tara, Manjushri. I think, yeah, ones like that. They're Vajrasattva, the lower tantra Vajrasattva. Or else highest yoga tantra initiations, like when His Holiness came out to give Kala Chakra initiation, or Yamantaka and Vajrayogini initiation, or Haruka Vajrasattva. So kind of the lower ones or the higher ones. Was there any other question about that, of the classes of tantra? Francesca?
Well, not so much about the classes of tantra, but, you know, like in the day, you know, back in the early 90s, you know, we sort of were encouraged to just jump in and take any initiation that was available, because it was sort of said that, you know, if you don't sort of get it in this life, it'll plant the seed for future lives and, you know, you'll meet it again and again. But then in the same token, you know, it's sort of said that there are problems with taking initiations and things like that, and then not meeting your commitments, because it detracts from the person who's given you the initiations and causes them obstacles and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a little bit...
Yeah, that's true. There's always a balance, Francesca. And so the commitments, though, often the commitment is to recite the sadhana or to recite various mantras. And that's something that we can do even if we do it really poorly. So, you know, for some years of my life, I managed to keep all of my commitments. And like at school, I managed to keep them all. Then I left school, left home, and kind of things went down the gurgler for a bit. And then I felt all riven with guilt. And I was at teachings with Lama Zopa Rinpoche at Chenrezig Institute, and I just had this thought, I have to do the Damsig Dorji retreat. And he'd been talking about that and said, I don't know, anyway, to just like hit me between the eyes, this is what I have to do, and I have to do it right now to purify all my broken commitments. So I went and did that that retreat by myself at Chenrezig Institute for about, I don't know, I think it was 10 days or a week or something like that, and managed to clamber back on the wagon that way for quite a few more years. Then I fell off the wagon again. So, I mean, it's kind of like if you're studying with someone who's really famous, and then you bring the school into disrepute, you know, it has an effect, yes. Ultimately, I don't think it's a terrible, terrible effect. And our precious gurus wouldn't give the initiation if it was going to harm. And in fact, when an initiation is advertised, like with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, sometimes it doesn't happen. So it doesn't happen because people don't have the merit, or it isn't going to benefit. So we can trust our guru that if we're there and the initiation's happening and we're sincere and we do the very best that we can, of course we're samsaric beings, and if we fall off the wagon, then we just clamber back up again. And I mean, part of that is to be able to practice guru devotion and do Vajrasattva mantras or do guru puja to purify that broken samaya, that broken relationship. That's what guru puja is there for.
Okay. Just another comment. It's hear one, see one, do one.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Hear one, see one, do one. So that's that. Yeah, I knew someone would know. Thank you. So I have heard at some Dharma centers where that's how they do things, and I'm horrified at that, because that's not enough. That's like if you're going to teach someone how to fly an aeroplane, it's not going to happen like that. And we're not going to get in that plane if that's how it happened. Like, I would not trust the pilot. So for some things, it's got to be really, really stringent. And something like a tantric practice or something like working with a chemistry set or something like flying a rocket or a jumbo plane, lots of training. And the lineage, getting the right manuals and the right checklists and the good teacher and practice, practice, practice and encouragement to ask questions and all of those things. And even like, you know, with the, I watched some of those shows of the airline disasters, and some of them happened because, say, there was a bit cliched, but a couple of Japanese pilots. And so the junior pilot was too polite to his senior pilot and saw the senior pilot stuffing up but couldn't say anything, so the plane crashed. So it's the same thing too, if we're not really educated in this process and really got it what our priorities are, and we don't say anything when something's going wrong with our relationship with the guru, it's like that, we crash the plane. So we've got to really inform ourselves and know which bits are the important bits and which bits don't matter.
We're in the we're in the grip of a mouse plague, and you know, so can I do tantric offerings as water bowls, or do I need to put the rice out? Because you know, because aren't you sort of creating the negativity where if the mouse has taken something that's been offered to the Buddha, you know, just
So if the animals take something that's offered to the Buddha, it doesn't matter because they don't know that's what they're doing. So if your cat jumps up on the altar and drinks the offering bowl water, it's not bad karma for the cat. It's bad karma for us because we haven't protected the offerings. But it's not for them. So don't worry about that. In fact, after you've offered the water, you know, you can give the rest of the water to the cats. So the thing with the offerings, especially in the middle of a mouse plague, or if you've got cockroaches or other insects that invade the house, ants and things like that. So Geshe Tashi Sering often said, especially in retreats, it's really important to keep the offerings clean. And so you can just have them in a jar. And that's fine. You can have a nice jar. The whole reason that they put the offerings in rice is just to be able to sit the offerings up. So you don't have to use rice. For your offering bowl for food, you can have a bowl with a jam jar in it, or you can just have the jam jar on a nice saucer, something like that, with a lid. Don't need rice at all. Then for, you know, where you put in your incense or your candles, you can have something else that it stands up in. So sometimes people get those little glass jewels from the shop, you know, the jewels that you put in your vases to stop them tipping over.
Yep.
Use that instead of rice. And even with our tantric offerings on the altar for Tara, we've got like the two water bowls, but then I've got so they're crystal water bowls this way, and then I have an identical one, like a lid on the top. So the water's protected and the insects can't fall into the water because that they're there kind of for long term. So you can mix and match like that. The most important is for us to keep the offerings really clean. So Geshe-la really loved the idea that we can put everything in nice glass jars. Okay, Anthea had a question about black foods that give you gas. Yeah, and why do we avoid them? So for lower tantra, you avoid the black foods because they disturb the winds. So yes, they give you physical gas like onions and garlic and whatever. But that's just the coarse manifestation. What they actually do is disturb or inflame the subtle winds within the body. And so for the lower tantras in particular, when we're just starting out, we're trying to clear all of that. So we don't want to just make things hard for ourselves. Interestingly, they say like for the tanka painters, the artists, that do that very, very fine, concentrated work for hours and hours and hours, that there is a tendency that you can get lung, which is where you've got too much tight or concentrated energy, and it kind of goes to your head and sends you a bit crazy. Just like if you hold your breath for too much, too long. As you know, anyone who's tried to paint the little tiny eyes on a satsa, you know what it's like. It's pretty intense. So if that's your entire day. So they say for tanka painters like that, to eat lots of garlic, lots of meat, dig potatoes, and have lots of sex, because all of that grounds you. So it's not that they're inherently bad, but it's just that for the practices that we're doing, they're not going to be conducive. What else? So mentioning LTC being very cautious. So, and I think because, Geshe Tashi Sering taught here, you know, for so many years, 18 years, he was a FPMT Lama, resident at Chenrezi Institute, taught the in-depth Buddhist program and taught here as well. And so very learned Lama and explained things so incredibly well. And he's also very non-superstitious. So he didn't want anybody to do initiations because of charisma, because of advertising or rah, 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 but just really straight down the line. He didn't want people to come to teachings just because of the person, just because it was him teaching, but because it was the teachings of the Buddha. So for that, I think he kind of corrected a lean that had happened in the hippie times, where it was like, oh, you're going to this initiation, you're going to that initiation, very flippant, a little disrespectful, really not acknowledging the enormity of it. And also because so many people did jump into tantric practice at the deep end, taking high Sirga Tantra initiations, and then created a lot of negativity by telling everybody, I wish I hadn't have taken that initiation, or bagging the Lama, or not doing the practices, or having sex with everybody and saying it's Tantra, or all of these other things, like the, you know, the extreme on one side. So Geshe Tashi Sering came along and kind of corrected it with the other side, to be very cautious, to the extent that now I've noticed that people have in their mind, oh, I'll never be ready for Tantra, which is also completely incorrect, because all of the Lam Rim in Tibetan Buddhism is taught from the point of view of Tantra. The whole thing is from the point of view of Tantra. The way Lama Zopa Rinpoche teaches, everything is from the point of view of Tantra, and mostly from the point of view of High Circuit Tantra. It's all there if you kind of got the ears to hear it. So it's not like it's actually even a choice for if we're studying Tibetan Buddhism, we're already immersed in that mindset of from the point of view, the quickly path. So it's just kind of putting them all together. It's a little bit this way too much, then a little bit that way too much, and now we're trying to find an even keel. Right. Oh, good. Okay, a couple. So from Anthea, I feel like I really get Tantra naturally leaning toward it, but also feel obligated in a way, nervous thoughts about it. So, yeah, it's good to be nervous, but you've got to ask who is being nervous. So what you want to be nervous, who should be nervous on one hand is all of your inner saboteurs and the samsaric eight worldly concerns and the delusions. They should start getting nervous right now. Because soon they're going to be gone, banished, no room for them whatsoever. So sometimes you might actually start even feeling like that, like starting to feel a bit scared or a bit excited or just like, whoa, what? And that's a good sign. And then the other thing is to be careful. It's like having a baby, you know. You have to be careful. The responsibility is huge, but also there's no time to stop. Off you go. So that stopped some people having babies, but pretty much hasn't stopped most of the world having babies, has it? So It is good to have nerves because that makes sure that you keep safe. So don't try and get rid of the nervousness. But what you've got to do is make sure the nervousness is focused on the right thing. So for us Dharma practitioners, you know, at least Mahayana Sutra, the way that we make our decision cannot be a worldly one. We've got to be making our decision informed by the three principal aspects of the path. How are we leading our life in the world, but not of the world? How's the best way that we can lead our life that way? Miriam, so is Discovering Buddhism course during the day on Tuesdays in July? It is Discovering Buddhism, but they're at a different cycle of the course. So they're starting the unit all about karma. So that's almost halfway through, just getting onto halfway through. For each of the FPMT centres that offers Discovering Buddhism, they do them slightly differently in each centre. So what we do is a weekly class. Each unit's about 8 weeks with then a review class and a couple of other things. And it takes us about 3 years to go through the whole cycle. So this unit is the last one of the unit, the introduction to Tantra. It's the last one. And then we start at number one again, but they flow on very nicely. And people usually do the whole cycle several times in a row. The first time that you do Discovering Buddhism, the first 3 years that you do it here, it can be really intense because everything's new. And then the second go through is just incredibly joyous because you're going, aha, oh, I know what he's talking about there. Oh, I know that bit. Yes, I recognize that bit. And then you get to hear about it, all the nuances and the wonderful this way of looking at it, that way of looking at it. It gets richer and richer each time. So someone like Ben, I think he's on his fourth go round. Jade, who was coming here on Tuesday morning, she did Discovering Buddhism five goes round and then she died. So, you know, it's something that it becomes a lifestyle because it's the Lam Rim. It's the Lam Rim put together by Lama Zopa Rinpoche in an order that really works well with the Western mindset. So we just do it until we become enlightened. So we might be together for a while yet, folks. So you just join whenever you like, and within 3 years you would have completed one cycle. Oh, okay, so Jennifer, the interview and the email options. So the exam questions are there. If you want to just write them, put them in a document and email them to me, you can. But if writing them isn't so much fun, we could meet in person at Langri Chumba Center, or we could have a meeting on Zoom, just one-on-one, and go through the questions. So whichever way that you like. And then there's the creative option, which is you can make a board game that encompasses all of the topic, or do a mind map that encompasses it, or a collage, or write a story. So some people have become very inspired. For the Samsara Nirvana unit, Jordan wrote a 30-page story, a lot like Lord of the Rings style, about a fellow called Jed, and it incorporated the Four Noble Truths and all the Dakinis and this incredible adventure, and it was just like non-stop action. It was incredible. And the whole lot of the unit was in there in this story. So it's entirely up to you. Just email me whatever you like to do and we can sort it out. Okay, so the board game is kind of an option for assessment, but it's not direct enough. So if you come to every single board game event that we have over the 3 years, you might have had a few questions on each of the units. But really, it's up to karma. You know, you pick up a card and it takes ages to get through whatever it says, and we have discussions about it and help each other out and tell stories and whatever, and everybody may only get one go each for the whole class. I mean, who knows? So it's just part of it's not so much the assessment for the course as a way of starting to integrate the Dharma and become used to talking about worldly stuff from a Dharma point of view. And who else do we get to do that with except our fellow Dharma students? You know, it's very rare to have that at home over the dinner table. Unless you're Anne and Steve, then you probably do have it at home over the dinner table, or Francesca and Malcolm. But, you know, so just to be able to talk in this Dharma milieu, it's really nice. And then karma takes care, whatever question comes up, well, that's the one. Yes, Francesca?
Yeah, you were talking about Candrala, and you mentioned something about maybe collating the questions that were asked. I had the most phenomenal experience watching it, and then I seemed to sort of swoon or something towards the end, and I mean, I was awake, but it was just weird, you know, and was she in front of some odd background? Because she seemed to sort of keep, when she led back, she was disappeared.
She's
and I'm going, and I was just, and she was in and out, and parts of her robe were sort of disappearing as well. Yeah, so anyway, so I think
my okay. It was extraordinary. She was appearing out of the Dharmakaya and shimmering back in again. Absolutely.
She was moving in and out, yeah. So are they going to sort of document the questions that she answered?
I don't know what's going to happen, because it was a joint effort between France, Italy, Spain and Australia and Nepal. I mean, it was a cast of thousands. They had 7-8 interpreters. I don't know what kind of IT going on in the background. You know, like we're talking about beforehand, they were set up for 1,000 people and then there was still more coming. So then they quickly opened it up for more. So I think it was just over 2,000 people. But Steph said that she had 6,000 hits on her on the Facebook posting. So that was just from the Australian one. It could have. Anyway, so she did say that she would do another teaching and answer those questions. So the organisers will collate the questions and she will do another teaching. She may not go through those questions, but she'll read the questions and then give a teaching. And she did say that she would. So as to when that is, we don't know. So as to what will happen with that talk, I'm not sure if it'll go up on YouTube or if it'll be available anywhere or what will happen. At the moment, it's very amorphous, and it was just who had the merit to be there at the time and then hear whatever you could hear and that's it, very ephemeral.
It was amazing.
Yes, really mind-blowing. So, but meanwhile, then the next night, Geshe Zopa's teaching on the Four Immeasurables was equally mind-blowing. And so that one I'll be editing and it'll go up onto YouTube and on our website and everything. And in particular, because it's on, you know, kindness and compassion and equanimity and joy, keeping the joy, it's a non-religious thing. So it's a really fantastic teaching for the non-religious or for those who would be, if they're going to be anything, they'd be Buddhist, but they're not religious. You know, it's ideal for that, really amazing. I really hope that you dive into the assessment, the exam, and give it a go, because of course just trying to answer a question is good enough in my book. and whatever, you know, as long as you just, even if you just email me something, then I'll just send you the answer key And then it's got the answers in there, and then you'll be able to figure out, oh, yeah, I didn't do so badly after all.